This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Research tells us that when a woman earns revenue, she reinvests about 90% in the education, nutrition, and health of her family, as opposed to 35% for men. So it makes a lot of business sense, economic sense, to empower women and invest in them.
That's Vanessa Mongar, the Director of Gender, Women, and Civil Society at the African Development Bank, on investing in women to promote economic stability in fragile countries. Details coming up also. An anti-corruption drive in Zimbabwe is auditing the lifestyle of officials to determine who was living beyond their income. And the UN is urging Tanzania's government not to forcibly deport tens of thousands of Burundians, political refugees. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa delivered the annual State of the Nation address today, offering reassurances that his government is committed to making the country a better place. The opposition MDC party wasn't receptive to the message, walking out as they have several times when he has spoken in the past. Reporter Kuzazi Nawashi has the details.
The State of the Nation address during the opening of Parliament started with a moment of silence, paying tribute to Zimbabwe's long-time former ruler, Robert Mugabe, who died last month. Facing a major economic crisis that has led to food and fuel shortages, massive inflation, and public service strikes, Mnangagwa said his government has made progress and is fighting for more.
My government continues to take bold and decisive steps to open up and grow the economy for the benefit of all our people. We are reforming our economy. We are reforming the political space and the very public of our society.
The address comes after government has taken the fight to cash barons in the black market, where they forced the biggest mobile money operator to suspend some of its services. Mnangagwa said the depressed economy required government to support some key sectors.
The sustained turnaround of our economy hinges on focused support for the productive sectors, especially agriculture, mining and manufacturing. The 2018-2019 drought has seen our agricultural sector registering a negative growth rate. Going forward, government has set aside Zimbabwe dollars, $1.8 billion, towards the production of strategic crops, such as maize, soybeans, and cotton.
Through an input support system, government is going to supply machinery, seeds, fertilizers, and other farming inputs to farmers. But Mnangagwa said only those with a proven track record will have access to the loan system. Mnangagwa urged farmers to grow traditional grains in light of climate change. He also expressed concern that the same climate change has affected Zimbabwe's hydropower plant, resulting in persistent power cuts. The speech paints a lot of progress, which many ordinary Zimbabweans may be blind to, given the prevailing and worsening effects of economic decline. For VOA, this is Kuzazi Nawashi from Harare.
Zimbabwe's Revenue Authority has netted dozens of its own officials in an anti-corruption drive that included a lifestyle audit to determine who was living beyond their income. But critics say higher-level officials are slipping through the net. Adigando gives us more on the story.
Last week, the Zimbabwe Revenue Authority, ZIMRA, revealed that 36 officials from the tax collection body have been suspended from between January and June, according to the state media. The Revenue Authority also says it is making efforts along with the Zimbabwe Anti-Corruption Commission to recover ill-gotten wealth where individuals' assets are outstripping their declared income in tandem with the newly promulgated Money Laundering and Proceeds of Crime Act. While applauding the Revenue Authority's ongoing efforts, civil society and clergy are not convinced that government is serious about tackling the scourge and culture of corruption and institutional graft. Reverend Ray Motsi of the Zimbabwe Theological College speaks on the development.
We expect that those in the front would lead by example and would also guide. We do also believe that this needs to be done in a comprehensive way without discrimination. This must be applied right across the board so that the message is very clear to everybody of what is happening.
Motsi says transparency and equality before the law are key issues with the current anti-corruption drives that the government is touting.
We are really wanting to see a bigger picture that is comprehensive, that is able to exude confidence to the nation, because at this moment the confidence of the nation towards government and what government can do is very, very low. We really think that what we see is the tip of the iceberg. If all government officials, including particularly those in the security, the military, the PIOs, the police, they all need to be investigated. It shouldn't just be an audit that is targeted to the small fishes in the pond.
Observers cite, for example, the case of former chief executive of the Zimbabwe Revenue Authority, Geshom Phasi, who was fired over allegations of graft more than 2 years ago. His case is still not gone for trial, while cases of smaller fish are rushed through the courts, an approach which undermines public confidence. Dumisani Nkomo of Christian non-governmental organization Habakkuk Trust concurs on the need for the anti-corruption drive to start at the top.
I think it's important to start right at the top, to start with the president, to start with the cabinet, rather than target your smaller, middle-level officials. We want to know the source of income for the president, for the presidium, for the cabinet, and whether this is commensurate with their lifestyles.
According to Nkomo, whose organization works in the rural region of Matabeleland, the systemic corruption and theft of public funds is deplorable, saying vulnerable citizens bear the brand.
It affects service delivery and development, because people in public offices end up siphoning money for development, and instead of that they end up relying on bribes as a source of living at the expense of development, at the expense of service delivery.
Meanwhile, the Minister of Tourism, Prisca Mfumira, who has been detained for more than 2 months on abuse of office charges, has been released on bail after several failed attempts. Observers say time will tell whether the alleged corruption case will stick. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo.
The UN Refugee Agency is urging Tanzania's government not to forcibly deport tens of thousands of Burundian political refugees to their home country, where it says their lives would be at risk. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Media reports indicate the Tanzanian government is ready to start deporting refugees to Burundi on Thursday. This is in line with a bilateral agreement the country signed in August to send the refugees home by the end of the year. The UN Refugee Agency says it is following these reports with worry and concern. UNHCR spokesman Barbara Balash tells VOA his agency hopes Tanzania and Burundi will not pressure or push refugees who fled persecution.
Many refugees and asylum seekers who have even recently arrived in Tanzania have cited persecution and fear of human rights abuses as the reason for their entry into Tanzania. So we hope that Tanzania will not put refugee lives at risk by putting pressure on them to return back home.
In 2015, Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza triggered widespread protests when he declared his intention to run for a third term. Government persecution and human rights abuses against opponents caused more than 340,000 people to flee to neighboring countries in search of refuge. Around 200,000 are in Tanzania. The UNHCR, Tanzania, and Burundi signed a tripartite agreement in March 2018 to facilitate the voluntary return of refugees to Burundi. Baller says the UNHCR hopes both countries live up to this agreement and ensure that all returns are voluntary and conducted in safety.
Hundreds of refugees still continue to flee Burundi. For us as UNHCR, the conditions are not conducive at this point to promote refugee returns in mass. More than 5,000 refugees have fled this year as well.
Over the past 2 years, more than 74,000 refugees have returned to Burundi, reportedly because of bad conditions in the camps and pressure from the Tanzanian government. Last month, the UN Commission of Inquiry on Burundi reported that serious human rights violations, including crimes against humanity, continued across the country. The three-member panel said the targets were real and suspected opposition supporters, including Burundians who have returned from abroad and human rights defenders. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
16 past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Faiz Sarj, leader of the UN-recognized Government of National Accord in Libya, has called for resumption of the UN-led peace process. His rival, General Khalifa Haftar, commander of the Libyan National Army, said he is willing to sit down at the negotiating table. Germany plans to host an international conference, bringing them and their external allies together in an effort to stop the proxy war. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed the latest push for dialogue with Wolfgang Poschtei, policy and security analyst at the Council for U.S.-Libya Relations.
But General Haftar, commander of the Libyan National Army, said he was open also to dialogue and to sit down at the negotiating table. His army declared a few weeks ago that a military solution was the only way out. How do you explain this change of positions?
Actually, Haftar, or better, his spokesman, made a precondition for this. He said, his words, this national dialogue is impossible as long as terrorists and criminal groups still control all aspects of life in Tripoli. End of the quote. So I don't see a real change of position. Of course, he's open to negotiations. He was always open somehow to negotiations. But his key point is still that he wants to wipe out what he calls terrorist groups in Tripoli beforehand. So actually, although there is an increasing time pressure on him to deliver results, whatever these results may be, I don't think that this marks a change of his position.
French Foreign Minister stressed that there will be no military solution in Libya and an international conference will be held in Germany next month, bringing together Libyan conflict actors and their external allies in order to exert political pressure to stop the military competition and proxy war in Libya. Would that work?
There is a requirement for a political solution. There is no doubt about it. But only after the dust has set on the battlefield. For the time being, there is still the war going on the battlefield. I'm not optimistic about any ceasefire and a political solution anytime soon. Actually, I'm not even confident that the right persons who have the real power in their hands on the ground will sit down around the negotiation table anytime soon. Two examples, Sarraj and the Misrata militias and the Tripoli militias reject any inclusion of Haftar into those negotiations. Nevertheless, he is clearly the leader in the East, and I don't see anyone replacing him anytime soon. On the other side, Sarraj is certainly still not in a position to negotiate on behalf of the Misrata or the Tripoli militias. He's simply not in charge there. So who should negotiate on their side? And with whom should he talk in the East if Haftar is rejected? So Unfortunately, some more changes on the battlefield will be necessary before both sides are ready to accept any deal and before the right people sit down on the negotiation table.
But why do you think General Haftar is attacking Sirte while its forces were the ones that rooted out ISIS from the city?
I don't think that he cares so much about the war against ISIS. For him, it is that this is a hub of power for the Misrata, and this is a strategic position to challenge his rule over the oil crescent, and this is also a strategic position to interrupt his logistic lines. And so as long as Sirte is in the hands of the Misrata, there will be a threat to the oil crescent, and as long as Sirte is in the hands of the Misrata, there will be a threat to his logistic connections from the west to the east. And this is the reason. Of course, we need to be aware the Misrata were key in fighting, together with American air power, the Islamic State in Libya in Sirte. And this is certainly a reason why the Americans will not fully give up on the Misrata. I think for the American foreign policy, it is still a key issue to hold somehow the hand over the Misrata and to protect them from any kind of decisive defeat.
That was Wolfgang Pochtei, policy and security analyst at the Council for U.S.-Libya Relations. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. The International Criminal Court says an alleged jihadi leader from Mali will face charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity for his actions during the repressive takeover of Timbuktu by Islamic extremists in 2012 and 2013. No date has been set for the trial of Al-Hassan Abdulaziz on allegations of torture, rape, sexual slavery, and deliberately attacking religious buildings and historic structures. Al-Hassan served as the city's de facto chief of police before a French-led military operation ousted the regime of Ansar Dine, an Al-Qaeda-linked group. Al-Hassan has claimed he is innocent and made incriminating statements because he was tortured while being questioned. Of the 2 billion people that the United Nations estimates live in fragile or conflict-affected areas, a disproportionate number are women and children. To many of the economists and policymakers at the UN General Assembly, empowering women is the key to creating peace and promoting economic stability in places experiencing or emerging from crisis. VOA's Adam Phillips attended a side event called Empowering Women in Zones of Conflict in Africa. He spoke with Vanessa Mongar, Director of Gender, Women and Civil Society at the African Development Bank. She explained why women were the main focus.
There's two reasons why we have a focus on women. Number one, because they've been marginalized for far too long, so they don't have the same access as the other part of the world to almost all productive resources. And because of that, they cannot contribute fully to society's resilience and growth. That's one. But the second piece is when you actually empower women economically, it has more impact on the society she lives in. Research tells us that when a woman earns revenue, she reinvests about 90% in the education, nutrition, and health of her family, as opposed to 35% for men. So it makes a lot of business sense, economic sense, to empower women and invest in them.
How does that relate to women who are in war zones or places where even there's low-level violence?
So we define conflict areas and fragile areas in many ways, right? Because you have wars for sure, but you also have all of the conflicts caused by climate change and other societal shocks. That's the new normal for many women in many African societies. I go to even refugee camps areas where people are still living and still trying to make ends meet. So making sure that women actually have the tools to be empowered economically, even in these particular settings, is crucial because even when the conflict is over, resilience doesn't come overnight. So you need to build resilience from within for societies to be able to stand on their 2 feet, and we know that women are the best to be able to lead that.
What kind of tools are you talking about?
As a development institution, we actually have studied a lot of the interventions of the past 50 years because it's not a new problem, and we know that many things haven't worked. So we're looking at leveraging partnerships in order to have more impact on the ground. Specifically in conflict zones, we're partnering with organizations such as the ICRC, the International Community of the Red Cross. Why? Because as soon as the conflicts erupt, the development institutions leave, and we leave the most vulnerable people behind, only humanitarian institutions stay on the ground. However, their traditional responses are not enough. Medical relief and food relief doesn't help societies get back on their feet. So now we have to work together to leverage their presence on the ground and our economically driven solutions in order to tackle those problems. That's the latest innovation from the African Development Bank's perspective.
Can you give me a specific example in Africa where this has happened or where you're trying to make it happen?
So in Niger, specifically, I actually traveled to Niger in January with the ICRC to look at specifically where we could implement that program. And we visited some camps of internationally displaced persons as well as migration hotspots in Agadez in the north. And there, some pilots were done. Some women were equipped with just a little amount of cash as a microloan, as well as some capacity building training so that they could run a small business. And you can see the results. A year later, you find the woman that had access to the equivalent of about $100, who's now making revenue every month and hired two people and can sustain her own family. Of course, it's a women-led household because she lost her husband in the conflict, but now she can feed her children and send them to school. That's the kind of impact we want to see.
That must be very gratifying to see.
It is. What's breaking our hearts is that we need to be much faster. So we have too many pilots on the continent, too little, too slow, and we need to be having impact on a much, much bigger scale if we want Africa to progress the way it should.
Vanessa Mongar, Director of Gender, Women and Civil Society at the African Development Bank. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Botswana has started offering free antiretroviral therapy to foreign sex workers following a decision to extend treatment to non-citizens. An estimated 30,000 foreigners living in Botswana are HIV positive, and most are sex workers. Until now, the Southern African nation was one of only a few countries that did not offer treatment to non-citizens. From Habrone, Botswana, Mokandisi Dube has more.
35-year-old Mary Banda is an HIV-positive sex worker from Zambia. In deteriorating health, she struggled to get treatment since she arrived in Botswana in 2018. Now she has a lifeline thanks to a Botswana government decision to offer life-prolonging antiretroviral therapy to non-citizens.
I'm very happy because most of people, they'll be saved, especially those who were struggling from taking ARV back home. When they called us and they started helping us, we couldn't believe that it's really happening. We thought that they're just talking.
Banda says health officials have been helpful and monitor how sex workers respond to treatment.
When they called us and they started helping us, we couldn't believe that it's really happening. We thought that they're just talking, but after they've given us, they make sure that they do follow up to check if the tablets are okay, if there's nothing like side effects or whatever.
The Botswana government's decision has been hailed by non-governmental organizations as a step towards fighting the epidemic. Teboho Haritsani, a legal and advocacy officer at the Botswana Network on Ethics, Law and HIV, Bonela, describes the development as progressive.
Sexual relationships are indiscriminate. So that is to say we cannot provide ARVs for a certain portion of people who live in the country and yet not provide the same treatment to another subset of the residents of the country.
The local sex workers organization Sisonke director Tosh Berger also welcomes the move.
We are very excited by this move. It's long overdue because we've been fighting for migrants to get ARVs. It's a milestone.
But for now, of the estimated 30,000 HIV-positive foreigners in Botswana, only 7,000 are getting treatment, according to the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Habaroni, Botswana.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Justin Twait, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports, or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.